Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, welcoming you back for part 2 of the Ryan Stuka case. We're going to pick up with the text right where we left off in part 1.
And so, in the same way Ryan had the repetitive power to take people back to the top of the mountain on the lift, he would be very likely to indulge the symbolic gesture of someone else offering him the same emotionally. It mirrors what he offers. You get what you give, right? But the danger is that it will be in the form of drugs. So think of him early in the night offering his friend a lift, so to speak, and how that's the right thing to do. And so later on, that's going to come back to him in karma with someone saying, "Hey, bro, I'm going to give you a lift." And he's going to think of that in a positive manner because what he's looking to do is get high emotionally. Now, let's say you're on a ski lift to the top of the mountain and intend to ski a specific trail. What will happen to you along the way that parallels what we've been talking about? Well, when you look down, you'll see the straight white line beneath you again, but this time it's the ski slope. Now, what happens to the straight white lines over time? They disappear, right? I mean, Ryan's going to be there until April 16th, and why is he going to leave? Because the straight white lines are going to disappear. Ryan gives people a lift to the top of the mountain by placing them over the disappearing straight white line projected onto the green screen, in this case the green trees, and so what likely happened to him is that someone offered a lift to the top of the mountain emotionally with drugs, and he accepted it. We're always told that you get what you give. Do unto others, they say. But in the end, what we learn is that structure dictates tragedy works like that too. Ryan gave people a lift to the top of the mountain physically, which accommodates the body, or our physical reality. But to maintain balance, or even the false appearance of such in tragedy, an attempt must be made to merge that physicality with emotional change. Unfortunately, in this case, those changed emotions came by way of the manipulation of drugs. So instead of emotional sacrifice, we get a physical one, which quite sadly turns out to be Ryan. You're supposed to sacrifice the person you used to become the person you will be. But here, Ryan is going to be sacrificed. Anyhow, we're at Bottoms. There's a silent disco going on. I think we can assume that, by this point, the MDMA usage is underway, especially given the symbolism of rolling that we understand from masas. The picture of Ryan from that night in the silent disco shows a young man with enormously dilated pupils and a big smile, things commonly associated with, but certainly not evidence of, MDMA usage. According to Ryan's mother, Heather, James, Ryan's friend, first said no drugs were used and then admitted the MDMA usage to her. So at this point, all we need to infer from that encounter, or series of encounters, if it was more than one, is that James initially lied to Ryan's mother before reconsidering and offering a different truth, so to speak. And one would do that for a specific reason, called fear. If we fear consequences, we might be inclined to lie to limit our liability. So for James, whatever the reason might have been, when he was first questioned about this issue by Heather, he lied, specifically meaning that he displayed fear in relation to potential consequences regarding drugs. In such a desperate situation, why would James think anything less than full transparency was a wise choice? Without question, the reason, as it is for all liars lying about anything, is the fear of consequences for getting caught. So, why did James have so much fear in relation to drug usage? So let's keep that in mind as we move forward. Now, we know Act 2, as it does in any story, comprises the majority of the action. So whereas they went to Massa's for one drink and will proceed to an after party for a short time after in Act 3, the bulk of this narrative occurs inside the confines of Bottoms. From what I understand, a young woman Ryan had been involved with, to a greater or lesser extent, was present at the bar but did not attend the after party. I don't know if they were an ongoing thing or a one-night stand or similar, but she doesn't seem to play a role in this tale. Now, in a transcendence narrative, this is where the emotional change begins to occur, in Act 2. So since our protagonist is headed for tragedy, his form of emotional change, drug usage, will be manipulated by physicality. Young people, as they age, grow emotionally, strive, succeed, and fail, learn how to handle the peaks and valleys of adult life, and in the process, that experience allows them the wisdom to discard some of their previous tactics. Basically, you find a career and climb that mountain to feel great over time instead of dropping Molly and downing endless beer from a keg. We see, in Ryan's choice of both operating and riding the lift to the top of the mountain, that this issue, on a subconscious level, concerns him greatly, as it does most young people. How do I get where I'm going, especially when everybody around me expects me to reach the top? You can literally see him with a solution for getting others up there, but someone else has to operate the lift when he's on it. No matter what, he can't get himself to the top of the mountain. He needs a lift, not only on the chair, but emotionally in the form of the drugs. And it's perfectly normal for young people to experience the shock of realizing that their adult wins happen over time and aren't delivered instantaneously as they are with the chairlift and drugs. It's the point of the hero's journey, to realize it's a marathon, not a sprint. It's about endurance, about being able to go the extra mile, never quitting. And sadly, so very tragically, that same idea, and for that reason, infiltrates their partying. It manifests as not only drinking hard and doing a lot of drugs, but doing these things for a significant period of time, even late into the night or the next morning when the body and mind are exhausted. It mimics their parents being exhausted from the prolonged effect of hard work. So when they age into having to actually do that work, they often shed the hard partying, increasingly so, until ironically, they have kids who grow to do the same. So as a young adult on the precipice of taking that journey, your ascension is usually more so comprised of hedonistic pleasures like drugs, alcohol, and sex, which manifest ideas of ascension and feeling good about yourself. They each offer some form of climax. They're placeholders. They're simply manifesting a corrupted physical shortcut to what their parents have by way of ascension because they don't yet have the experience, ability, or resources to undergo the journey. They're in a purgatory in which they're figuring out their path to the top, whatever that means for them, but realize that only they are at the controls. So Ryan manifests the idea of physically putting himself at the controls of what will take him to the top of the mountain by being a lift operator below many viable paths above him, all of which are constructed with the disappearing straight line of the deity. Now, who is the deity in essence, in its most general form? The Father. That's who men transcend. Ryan, like a lot of young guys, is looking for a path to becoming his father, more or less, which, in our evolutionary narrative, is specifically the path up the mountain to the top. That's your physical reality. It's designed to accommodate your emotional life through reflection. Just watch this. His shift is from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., right? So watch the structural elements here, okay? 11 a.m., you have the 1-1 of the binary universe, completion, right? The 7 is the same thing, birth, life, death in a binary universe with the single deification stage, right? Now, how many hours are between 11 a.m. and 7 p.m.? There are 8, right? And if you take the number 8 and turn it horizontally, it's infinity. Now again, since the shift is 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., it means something important happens during that time period. Day turns to night. So, think of Ryan operating the lift in the light of being at the controls, and each time he does it, there's light in his life. But for some reason, even though he's at the controls, ironically, that path isn't taking him anywhere. It's not taking him to the top. He's stuck, stagnant. And because he stands there, stuck in one place and not moving, while everyone else around him seems to be going up the hill to the top with ease, darkness begins to overtake him. And when it does, by 7 p.m., when his shift ends, he gives up on getting there, on getting to the top of the mountain. Yet, the next day, he goes back and does it again. But even so, he's still stuck, and the darkness returns. He's trapped in a cycle, and it's because he is manifesting physicality from an emotional idea. A lot of us have lived that type of life and done it with a smile on our faces, no matter how false it might have been. I have. I know what it's like to feel like I'm taking other people up the mountain while, ironically, being stuck at the bottom beneath them. I know what it's like to watch others ascend while I go nowhere. I understand. And so, even though I didn't know this person, the one idea I always need to get across to everybody is that we all have internal lives where we're hurting. We all hurt. And most of the time, not even those closest to us know our true struggles, because we do not convey most of what goes on in our internal lives explicitly. It is left to be picked apart from the subtext of the actions and words we provide others. Now, think of that idea thematically, specifically as it relates to this case. What did I just say people ignore in favor of the facade we see on the outside? Our internal lives. We too often ignore what happens on the inside. Now think of the silent disco again. What are you ignorant of when standing outside the headphones? What's happening inside? The internal life. Likewise, when you search everywhere outside for Ryan, what are you ignoring? The internal life. It's the location of what happened inside his head and that house, along with what happened inside the heads of the others who were there. Like finding nothing but ignorance outside the headphones and all the answers or truth within about why people moved, behaved, or danced the way they did, aka took the actions they did, you have to do the same with that after-hours party house on Burfield Drive, which will now constitute Act 3. And what do we all know Act 3 constitutes, as I've broken down the structure for you? Death. Birth, life, death. Third stage is death. So Ryan's going to die at this place. It is structural inevitability. In a transcendence narrative, it's symbolic death or emotional death followed by rebirth. But in tragic fate, the unrealized emotional change manifests in physicality. So for Ryan, who's indulging physicality, the death in question will be just that. And rather than being disembodied in the traditional deified sense, like knowing a creator has to exist who created this universe or story, but one who's not available and present in physicality, Ryan's fate will mimic that through the manipulation of hiding his body and keeping him silent instead. Now, on our way up the evolutionary pathway to the top of the mountain, this vehicle of movement called evolution is indulging a process that is going to take us from many parts back into one called the singularity. If you look on a dollar bill from the United States, you'll notice the Latin e pluribus unum, which means from many to one. Now, examine that phrase again. E pluribus unum. What's the only mode of transportation in terms of a vehicle that is hidden within that presentation? Well, it's the three letters that form the word bus. So what comes up the hill, picking up Ryan's individual friends and merging them as a group inside as one as they rise? A bus. Now, don't put down that dollar yet. Look at the pyramid on the back, the one with the eye at the top. That eye is universal truth, which is achieved at the top of the mountain. And here's why you're seeing it in the form of a pyramid. Your universe is constructed of a single point of origin, a single image, and then on top of that image goes the next image, meaning the expanded and changed one that comprises this idea about the universe. What happens next? Each circle, as the stack travels upward, gets larger and larger, which accounts for the shape of a tornado or even the water in your drain. The ancient Egyptians, symbolically and intuitively understanding that concept, even if the science is still formulating thousands of years later, built monuments to symbolically connect the other side of that equation here on Earth, which manifests the shape of the infinite loop, or hourglass, if we're talking 3D terms. The pyramid, being built from the ground up, has the single block on top and widens with each layer going downward, mimicking the idea of the ever-expanding stack of circles that would connect to it on the other side, in the mirror universe. In the middle is the intersection of the seeker and the sought, or Jesus and God, or body and mind. So the notion being put forth by the Egyptians is that we meet God at the top of the mountain. But if we go down to the bottom, ultimately, we meet the devil. This concept is even understood by toddlers, as a staple of their play consoles over the years has been a stack of increasingly larger circles, or donuts, intended to be stacked in order of size from largest to smallest, going up. The universe is physically expanding, going ever outward, of necessity, and we, conversely, go back to the point of origin intellectually, reverse engineering it. Completion of that process can be found represented all over in places like the hourglass, the infinity symbol, the number 8 on the ball that wins in pool, and the bow tie, to name a few. If you held a mirror over the pyramids to mimic the idea of the mirror universe, you'd get the same. One chamber is the mind, while the other is the body. So as we understand with our own human minds, they do not occupy space in physical reality. Our bodies do that. So in our universe, God, the mind, is absent, and Jesus, the body, is present. The body is always, from a structural standpoint, down the hill. The mind is at the top. The ignorance is down the hill, while the enlightenment is at the top. Watch it manifest, like we see with the eye appearing at the top of the pyramid on the dollar bill. In Ryan's case, there were two known video cameras available to capture surveillance, one going up the hill and one heading down it. So by way of structural necessity, which of these cameras do we know is not going to work? The one going down the hill, right? On a symbolic level, going down the hill into the abyss and remaining stuck there, remaining mired in that swamp, causes what specifically? Ignorance. You can't see the truth, aka the light above. So on the dollar bill and on the mountain, the working eye is at the top. Only the top of the pyramid has an eye, and only the path going up the mountain has working CCTV. Going down breeds ignorance. So if you wanted to get rid of a body under the condition of keeping others ignorant, In which direction would you take it? Down the hill, to the abyss. Now, we traditionally go down to the dark waters of the abyss to cleanse ourselves of ego and be reborn into our authentic selves. So our ego is essentially the body we leave inside that cocoon, like the caterpillar becoming a butterfly, so that we may no longer be stuck or grounded and can ascend to the skies. We take on a different form by discarding our body, so to speak, in the identity of who we were, in order to become the person we're meant to be. That still happens in a sociopathic narrative. However, in a sociopathic criminal narrative involving death, as we see so prominently displayed in the Delphi murders, a killer will not sacrifice his own ego as symbolic of the body and emerge from the abyss reborn by way of emotional sacrifice. He, like the hillside strangler as well, will send others down the hill to a physical death instead of sacrificing himself emotionally and then come back up the hill reborn, absent of that identity he wanted to shed, in the form of the person's body who was sacrificed. So this is what I really need everybody listening to absorb right now. Basically, whomever takes Ryan there down to that abyss is going to be an older version of the person he was at the time, but one who never learned his lesson about getting up the mountain and so was still there doing the same thing years after he probably should have been gone. This is going to be someone that Ryan feared becoming in the future. Someone who couldn't get up that mountain, who remained stuck. Like the serial killer often seeks victims who remind them of their younger, more naive selves so that they can get revenge against that innocent person, an older person still living like Ryan was at 20 would recognize him for what he was and potentially drag him down into the abyss with an ironic promise of getting higher. Sometimes when we try to kill something emotionally, it spills out onto a physical canvas, even if born from a subconscious place, or an unconscious place where it's not realized whatsoever. I think this is probably someone whose emotional ascent allowed him to get no higher, and due to the symbolic resonance of that, in the same way Ryan wanted to get people higher and to the top of the mountain on the chairlift, this person wanted to do so by way of drugs, because otherwise he was incapable of being that person at the time. He hadn't grown into that role. But we see with Ryan that he was growing into that role. He was helping his friend and taking him to the top of the mountain. And so the thing that the older person is going to fear most is when he sees someone like himself who is going to change, who is going to get out. And when he sees that, what he's going to do is offer the same manifested solution of getting to the top of the mountain that's really going to cause the person to get stuck instead, because misery loves company. We don't like watching people ascend above us. Again, I think this is probably someone whose emotional ascent allowed him to get no higher in life, and he wanted company in that misery, so he asked Ryan to join him in indulging a drug that would get him higher than he already was, while knowing what Ryan was seeking, because it's what he's always been looking for as well. Most often, when people pass us by on the way up the mountain, and we're stuck, we grab at their ankles and force the same on them as a means of coping. It's revenge. Every person who has ever lived in a place where they wanted to get out and wanted to move somewhere far away and do great things has been oppressed by the people who were stuck there. And they're always like, why can't these people encourage me? And the reason is, that's how transcendence works. They're trying to drag you down into the abyss. It's revenge. It often happens in ignorance of any type of explicit awareness. But here's the truth. if you can't bring balance through sacrifice by emotional growth, you physically sacrifice others. This type of behavior is learned by children and reinforced as normal very early in life, most prominently in the form of bullying at school. The bully gets bullied at home by someone larger, so he goes to school and projects the same upon someone else in the role of himself to get balance with revenge. That's a more explicit version of it. Sometimes these situations can seem completely benign, such as when the alcoholic offers somebody a drink so he doesn't have to drink alone. There are people who also do that with cocaine, and lots of cocaine at that, simply because they don't want to drink alone with their emotional problems causing the drug usage. If other people are doing it, it becomes more acceptable, and the best target is someone who used to be like you, someone who wanted to get higher but didn't know how and tragically fell. In life, we need others to give us a lift, to take us higher, and sometimes when people attempt to do that for us, or we for others, our intentions become corrupted because the lift we try to give them, or they to us, results in a fall instead. That happens when we don't have anything to offer beyond the things that are already holding them back, so instead we offer them false comfort. Obviously, people with the same issues holding them back often end up in the same place. So in a situation in which Ryan offers a lift up the mountain to the skiers and snowboarders in order to ease their burden in that process, look what happens when he's noticed by the bus driver. The bus driver stops and does what? That person gives them the lift they need to get higher, to go up the mountain. That's a positive interaction, and among young people who party, it's also considered positive to offer drugs to someone seeking a lift to get higher emotionally. We all want to help each other get up the mountain, but sometimes, as people who take shortcuts, we lead each other down dangerous paths that end up with us getting lost. And sometimes, we don't return. And with Ryan being a lift operator, look what truth rises to the surface about his drug usage that night. The truth is that when people come down the mountain or down the hill, what does he do? He has to give them a lift back to the top. So if it's late night at an after-hours party, that idea still holds true. It has symbolic resonance. If you're coming down from the MDMA, you'll be looking for something that takes you back to the top of the mountain and does it quickly. And nothing does that. Nothing hits the reset button like the disappearing white straight line of cocaine. These people gathered here to do these jobs are all, in one form or another, indulging that narrative of getting back to the top of the mountain with the help of others because, quite frankly, when you undress our evolutionary narrative to its naked structure, absent of the social veil, that's all we do. Each of us is a vehicle designed to not only climb to the top of the mountain, but to take others with us. And in a world predicated upon equal parts darkness and light, to create a zero energy balance in which nothing is created or destroyed, yet infinite, we must have equal parts tragedy and triumph. For every person at the top of the mountain in light, someone is stuck below in darkness down in the abyss. In this narrative, I believe someone put Ryan down there and then ascended back up the mountain in a sociopathic narrative. The mirror universe, the abyss, or dark waters of the unconscious mind, is where you leave your old self, your ego, before ascending, reborn into the light. The ego goes back to a position of being unrealized so your authentic self can flourish in its place. It recedes below the surface, unseen, hidden, in darkness. And so, when killers dump a body down the hill, whether the hillside strangler or the Delphi Killer, the idea is to leave the victim at the place on the hill physically that represents the place where you got stuck emotionally. And if you look at either of those cases, or any of these cases where people are taken down the hill, so to speak, what you'll see is that right where the lift would be if that was a ski resort is where the victims are dropped. So Ryan is stuck in that place, both at the bottom of the hill working on the chairlift, and clearly, again, from structural necessity, that's where he is again now, just in a different location. The sociopath works like this. He's making a physical sacrifice outside of his body instead of an emotional sacrifice inside his mind. He won't change, so he changes others to compensate. It's the same reason you end up offering coke to others. If you can't get high, so to speak, emotionally through achievement, and you are unable to give others a lift, like the bus driver, then what you are left to do in the absence of those skills and ability and maturity is to give people a manifested lift up the hill. So, meaning something that is supposed to be emotional, it ends up being physical. You can't change emotionally, so can't help them up that mountain or getting high, so you change their emotions temporarily by physical means, and when it ends in tragic fate, you manifest the place where you're stuck emotionally as their physical resting place, down the hill. I mean, just consider the implications of going down the hill here. Could there be a better place than this mountain to manifest the idea of reaching rock bottom emotionally? Probably not, right? So let's go inside the house now and see if we can identify that person. More importantly, let's document the exit from the home, specifically the moment in which Ryan seemed to be leaving, but nobody ever confirmed that he did. We're told there are approximately 9 people in this house for the after-hours party, which is a bit less of a party and more like a small gathering. Ryan is there, along with his friend James, in addition to a male-female couple who are also roommates of Ryan and James. So, 4 of these 9 people actually reside at Ryan's house down the hill on Sun Peaks Road. I also gather that perhaps 2 of the 5 remaining people in the home are a couple who allegedly remained upstairs from the after-hours party and encouraged others to leave as they wanted to keep the gathering small and quiet for the purpose of needing to wake early. Now, that seems to leave 3 more people in the home, give or take. Though what I later learn, in relation to a photo that I'll mention, is that it's 4 people. So, I don't know who they are, but certainly the people close to this case have a better idea. I had heard whispers of these people perhaps being older, with one person being 26, and the other as old as 31, though I'm not entirely sure. However, what I can say is that I do believe someone older than Ryan would have perpetrated this act. So, what happens inside this home, beyond pure speculation and rumors, is a mystery to us, even to this day. We're told that Ryan leaves sometime between 1:30 and 2 a.m., though there doesn't seem to be much clarity on that issue in terms of specifics. In these types of situations, at parties, most people don't pay attention to the time very closely. Now, we're told that Ryan and friends go to this house because they're just checking out what's going on there. This place is supposedly nicknamed Sunday Funday, and so it is seemingly known as a party house. The question is why? Is this just a place to party, or is it somewhere you can also buy drugs? If so, what kind of drugs? We really don't know. I guess what I'm wondering is if the primary purpose of this trip to the Sunday Funday house could have been to buy drugs. I ask because if something took place in which multiple people in Ryan's group purchased some type of drug like cocaine from someone in the house, and Ryan died while using it, it stands to reason the blame, in the form of criminal liability, could fall upon the shoulders of them all, which is the type of conspiracy in which you actually do find willing participants who can keep a secret. If everybody is going down if caught, it's better for everyone to stay silent. Sometimes they do, other times they don't. Now, this is how we're told Ryan's friends leave the house. James is first. He leaves alone, shortly before Ryan. Soon after, the couple, who are Ryan's roommates, decide they're going to leave. They tell us that when they're walking out the door, they see Ryan behind them, and he seems to be in the process of putting on his coat and shoes, which obviously insinuates that he's going to leave as well. So if his roommates see him getting ready to leave into the dark, freezing cold, with snowbanks as high as 14 feet, why do they proceed to disregard him and continue out the door? This is one of those very important areas where people are rationalizing with bullshit logic derived from reason, and to combat that nonsense, I'm going to show you, from a structural standpoint, how I understand Ryan was already dead and could not have accompanied them in that moment. They didn't wait because they couldn't. He didn't follow because he was dead. But by saying he was right behind them, even to the extent of suggesting they looked behind them while walking down the road, yet didn't see him, they offer a narrative in which he was alive and left the house of his own volition. Yet, neither they, nor James, or anyone else, commits to Ryan leaving. Now, remember how James lied about the drugs to Heather at first, and then upon reconsidering, told her the truth? It says he was going to go one way, but then he changed his mind and went the other after reconsidering. So when he walks out the door of this home, if he's indulging sociopathy in a manifested narrative, this motherfucker won't be able to hide the idea of going one way before deciding to backtrack and going the other way. And why will he do such a thing? The potential consequences, specifically of falling down the hill at a ski out. So let's watch him go. Let's have James exit the front door. I already know what's going to happen. What does he do? He says he chooses to turn right down the street before reconsidering and going back the other way, which is obviously left. Now, place that physical template on top of his emotional circumstances inside the home as it pertains to a drug overdose killing Ryan, and what do those actions say? They say exactly this: I was going to do the right thing, but then I did what? Left. It tells us James was going to do the right thing in the same way he initially went right on the street, but then he turned back the other way and left due to what? Fear of consequences. Falling down the ski out. Going down the hill. So again, our universe goes from one as the singularity to 1-0, and then the 0 is extracted in favor of a second 1, which becomes redundant due to the existence of the first, leaving us to cross them like we see on the crucifix of Christ, so that two crossing straight lines informs us about Jesus, while one straight line speaks to the existence of the Father, God. So think of birth as the 1, or singularity, giving way to the 1 and 0 in binary coding, or straight line and circle, in the second stage of life, otherwise known as man and woman, and then in the third stage, death, the circle is extracted for a second 1, which becomes redundant and does what? Disappears. It means the universe goes from one straight white line to a straight line connected to a circle to two straight lines that cross or merge, making one disappear, aka disembody, like Christ crossing the border of the Holy Ghost into becoming God. Probably sounds crazy, But this is easy. Let's align that narrative with how these people leave the house, and we should see perfect consistency throughout. Again, I use the term structural inevitability a lot, but it's because I really need to get across the point that your reality is comprised of symbolic narrative. So James leaves first. He's a white male, and like we said, men are the one. So he is consistent with the white straight line. And it's just him. So he represents the singularity that begins this universe. Now, how does evolution move, so to speak? How does it climb? Well, we simply look at the mountainside again at a hiking trail, or endeavor to understand politics, meaning movement uphill takes place by way of alternating switchbacks taking you from right to left and back again. So notice James manifesting that idea by first going right and then left. Your physical reality and mine is nothing more than that stupid story played out over and over again with as much window dressing in the form of drama and visuals to keep us all ignorant of how incredibly simple it is. It's supposed to be intuitive to us because that way we do not see the explicit rendering of the same stupid shit over and over. But as we are now dealing with a lot of considerations related to artificial intelligence, well, gonna have a lot of really weird people on the autistic spectrum telling you all sorts of crazy shit about how you're built. But that's just how it goes. We're moving into that time. So in the beginning, there is just a one, the singularity, that's him. But notice that since this is a manifested tragedy, James going right then left doesn't take us up the hill. It is not ascension. Rather, it's a descent. It takes us down. Only emotional growth would lend itself to an upward trajectory. So James is leading the way down the hill, so to speak, which means that what must come next, due to absolute structural necessity, is the one suddenly branching off to become 1-0 in the binary universe. Now, if the man is a one and the woman the zero, guess who's next to leave? Again, structural necessity. It has to happen this way, and it does. It's the male-female couple who are Ryan and James's roommates. So, that gives us our 1-0. So we see our new universe going from 1 to 1-0 in the respective stages of birth and life. We have the first stage with James coming out, then the second stage with the couple. Now comes the third stage, or death, which means the next people to leave the house or womb and go down the hill, again, due to structural necessity, must be two straight lines that crossed, but one disappeared, in the same way the body of Christ vanishes crossing the threshold of the Holy Spirit and gives way to God's pending disembodiment. So, if Ryan's vanishing was due to the disappearing straight white line, meaning the cocaine, then by default of the manifested construction at hand, he will become exactly that, the disappearing straight white line in this narrative. Now, what does that mean about who comes out the door of the home next? It says that if we begin with a one when James leaves in Act 1 and then make that universe a 1-0 when the male-female couple leaves, then the last or third stage, or death, will need one living man or straight line and one disappeared straight line or man. Structurally, these people have to be Ryan, who suffered the straight line until disembodiment, like Jesus, and died, but won't be resurrected, along with another man who, like God, remains nameless and faceless as we reverse engineer the universe back to him and prove it's his creation that led us to this truth. And again, since the world is only transcendent or ironic at any given moment, what will happen is that Ryan is given a lift that leaves him at the bottom. Now, if you look at a ski lift coming down the hill, which had just gone to the top, what is the first thing you notice? The people on board are gone, right? They've all disappeared. That's what happens to you when you sink down into the abyss, aka go downhill. So you'll notice the lift operator is not charged with bringing people down to his level. He only lifts them up. That's the point. Somebody gave Ryan a lift, but it was downhill to their level, and upon arrival, like the people leaving empty chairs, he disappeared. Like those patrons, he was taken to the top of the mountain, emotionally, through the drugs, and then disappeared when he came back down. Like those patrons, Ryan would never get off the lift at the bottom of the hill. When he reached that place, like the lift shows us, he had disappeared. And of course, the point of those things coming back downhill with nobody in them is to say you are supposed to reach the disembodiment of deification when you reach the top, so that when the chair comes back down, it's completely disembodied. Lots of young people die emotionally trying to get up the hill of adulthood, and so what we see manifested in many horror movies is the idea of becoming stuck physically or suspended specifically in a way that kills you trying to get up that hill. Michael Myers stabs a young man through his chest, pinning the victim to a cabinet, and on another occasion, he uses a scalpel to stab a woman and hold her in the air, suspended. Leatherface, of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre fame, infamously used a hook on which he hung victims, manifesting the idea of them getting stuck at the bottom of the hill, unable to escape and dying there. If you look at a hook, you see that you can go down the hill on one side, meaning down the hill and through the abyss of change at rock bottom, but when you try to go back up the other side of the hook, or hill, which represents trying to climb into adulthood, that's where the sharp part is. That's what kills you, that's where you get stuck. So whether you're fishing in the depths of a mirrored lake, or leaving a dead victim on a hillside, the idea is that they get stuck or trapped in that place, and that's how we get the phrase, on the hook. If you're on the hook for something, you're stuck there. Now again, the universe is written by a bunch of bots slinging all sorts of ridiculous bullshit. So when I see this story involving James and understand the implications, it will take me about 2 seconds to find another similar story about a hook in which someone named James is stuck because of a decision involving accidental death that started with doing the right thing but culminated with going the other way and the person left. Of course, the lowest hanging fruit within this consideration is the absolutely atrocious but relevant 1997 horror flick, I Know What You Did Last Summer, in which a man who was accidentally and seemingly killed by a group of young people comes back to life with a hook for a hand, one that he uses to taunt, terrorize, and kill. But above all else, that hook is representative of getting stuck on the hill going into adulthood. And the protagonist, Julie James, notice the name, fears that the most because of her lies, specifically the decision to do the right thing before deciding to go the other way and leave. She literally participates in taking the dead man down the hill to the water and submerging him in the abyss where he disappears forever. Or so they think. He comes back to haunt them with that hook, and that hook is symbolic of dying on the hill heading up into adulthood. And the reason is that hook represents the inability, again, to get up the hill by way of emotional maturation. as long as Julie James indulges the lie about the man's disappearance and death, she suffers the fallout of clutching her ego tight, not transforming, not freeing herself through the conduit of the truth. She's on the hook, so to speak, stuck there until she changes emotionally and lets go of her ego. Unfortunately for her and us, she doesn't manage by the end of the film. And with that, we're forced to suffer the equally brutal I Still Know What You Did Last Summer prior to I'll Always Know What You Did Last Summer. And the reason, like most of these horror movies with all of these sequels, is that these people don't change. They never change, so they never get off the hook for what they've done. It haunts them emotionally, and that fear manifests as the man with the hook, just like it does with Leatherface, because that man's disappearance and death is what's killing them inside. They live with guilt, but have a dilemma because the guilt is seemingly never worse than the consequences. So they keep fighting the monsters over and over instead of maturing to free themselves from the hook through truth. Now, like our buddy James in this story about Ryan Stuka, Julie James, who wanted to do the right thing, but then left, suffers worse than everybody else involved. Strange, right? As much as the killer comes after everyone else with more liability in the matter, she gets it worse than all of them. Why? Well, the person with the least liability, the one who was going to do the right thing but then went the other way and left, is always the one with the greatest empathy for the victim and the one least involved in disposal. So while Julie James goes along with taking the man they killed accidentally down the hill to make him disappear in the abyss, her empathy also makes her the least willing participant, and again, due to that guilt, the most likely to talk in the aftermath. She is the protagonist, and the story is about her rather than being about the people with greater involvement, because her desire to do the right thing means something very specific. This character can be redeemed. It's in her heart, despite the mistakes she made and her terrible fear of the consequences to come if the truth comes out. What we notice at the end of I Know What You Did Last Summer is that when Julie James is asked if she knows why the man who disappeared would want to kill her, she says no, meaning that lie to avoid consequences prevents her from being cleansed in the abyss. So the final scene, accordingly, and by way of structural necessity, shows her getting ready to take a shower, meaning intending to cleanse herself of her mistakes, but she never does because as she goes to do it, she receives a note in the steam on the shower's glass. I still know what you did last summer. Then her problem with the man with the hook chasing her persists, because she hasn't addressed the problem emotionally.
Okay, so I'm going to wrap it up there for part 2, and you can jump on over to part 3 for the conclusion, which is available now.